The practice that we explore is so simple. This was the focus or the emphasis of the reflection during the meditation. The simplicity of awareness. It takes that simplicity to be able to receive, to see, the complexity of our human experience. The meditating mind, the mind that's aware, if it has any agendas or plans or things that it's looking for, all of those activities will get in the way of seeing what's here. Seeing the subtlety and the complexity of what's here. It's mind-blowing what the mindfulness and wisdom can see. And the orientation of our curiosity about watching experience is to understand our human experience. And so that's what is revealed. In particular, the questions around suffering, how the complexity of this human mind creates suffering, and how those processes can be shaped through wisdom, through compassion, towards the release from suffering. There was a question that was submitted yesterday that kind of speaks to this. I'll read the question and then respond a little more directly. On the first day, you said in response to someone's question that you wouldn't go digging. I have a tendency to want to see the deeper, in quotes, subtle states, subtle levels of phenomena experience, believing them to be more important and where insight awaits. And so I have a slight aversion to looking for what's obvious. Can you please speak to the benefit of noticing what's obvious and how, when to go beyond what's obvious? There are different approaches, as we've been exploring and talking about, different approaches to practice, to meditation. The Mahasi approach, the approach taught by Mahasi Sayadaw, Sayadaw Upandita, emphasizes first a cultivation of concentration, of one-pointed focus on a particular object. And then when that is pretty stable, I was told by Sayadaw Upandita to stay with the breath until I could stay with it for an hour before opening to other experience. When that mind has that kind of focus, when it does then open to other experience, it tends to be seeing in that very subtle way. And so that can be, seeing in that subtle way, seeing seeing how the arising of something leads to something else, and just watching the kind of the complication of the mind unfolding in front of us, which we might be able to see in that kind of a situation, that kind of a focused mind. And the kind of focus that the Mahasi approach encourages is a very detailed, precise kind of focus. It's very, you're looking at in the breath, just the very subtle sensations in the breath. And so it's cultivating that kind of mindfulness. And so when we let go of the breath and open to other phenomena, we tend to see that kind of precise, subtle kind of phenomena. And that can be very cool, many of us not having seen that level of experience in our minds before. And it can be very freeing, particularly if we see how the arising of something is creating suffering and see the mind letting it go. It can be very freeing to see that everything is just this tumbling on of very deep and subtle kind of processes. This practice is not aiming the mind at any particular kind of object, any particular kind of awareness, actually. It's not aiming the mind to cultivate a particular flavor of mindfulness. It's in some ways opening to, you know, what's the awareness that's already here? You know, what's the kind of awareness that's available right now? Just starting there. And so in my own exploration of this practice, having done the Mahasi practice for quite a while before I met this practice, what I saw is, you know, I saw a lot of ideas very similar to what this questioner says, the kind of the idea that the insight awaits at the subtle level of phenomena. And certainly having trained in the Mahasi approach where that is the way in, that was an agenda, that was a kind of a belief. That's where and how insight would happen. And when I first started with Sayadaw Utejaniya, just like, okay, what's obvious? Are you aware? That's all that your work is. Just know that you're aware and take in what's here. It's like, this is way too simple. Insight's never going to happen with this practice. That was my belief. That was what, you know, it's like, I don't know about this. Fortunately, I kept going. I had committed to being there for 6.5 weeks. So, you know, I kept going. What I, you know, kind of a description in retrospect of what I saw was that starting in this very simple way, just what, you know, just the awareness that's here. I'm going to stop for just a second and kind of divert from that story for just a second and just explore the possibility or the kind of a model perhaps or an analogy of awareness of what we can know or be aware of as kind of being a column or, you know, just something, you know, that goes from maybe what we would call ordinary up at the top through down to subtler kinds of experiences and into these very subtle kinds of just momentary noticings. So there's a level of what we could call ordinary awareness, just our normal, usual, aware of regular objects in the room and, you know, able to walk around and navigate the space down to, you know, if you open your eyes, and I have experienced this on some retreats where I open my eyes and I don't see objects in the room. I just see form and color. It's not a kind of awareness or a perception. This is my understanding of the differences in these levels. It's what the perception is attuned to. Is the perception attuned to ordinary objects, or is the perception attuned in this deeper level to simply the bare sight, just form and color, no objects. In that place, I would not try to stand up and walk across the room. The mind cannot distinguish the difference between in that seeing place, that the mind can't distinguish the difference between the wall and the lamp. You know, it's just form and color. On the other hand, you know, I think I have some confidence in the mind's capacity to switch levels. It can switch levels. And so if there had been a fire alarm, you know, I think the mind would have switched levels and started seeing objects instead of just form and color. Because the difference between the levels that I'm talking about is a difference of perception. So even with continuity of mindfulness, even when the mind is completely continuous, the mindfulness is very continuous, it can experience things at an ordinary level, or it can experience things at this more subtle level. And I have on certain occasions on retreats seen the possibility to switch between levels with just a simple intention in the mind, sitting, waiting for an interview, and just experiencing no real sense of a stability of objects at all, feeling like everything was breaking apart, a lot of slipperiness, of kind of chaotic experience. And then in a moment, wondering, question, noticing that there was kind of an unpleasantness to that and a little bit of a resistance to that experience. And wondering in a moment if the mind could shift to ordinary awareness. Now that just arose as a thought in the mind. I didn't bring it up myself. It was just a kind of a wonder. And I was instantly in ordinary awareness, sitting in the hallway, waiting for my interview. And then the mind wondered, can I switch back to seeing everything in this deeply impermanent falling apart way, and back into that. So seeing this possibility, the mind can shift perceptual levels. This is what I would call malleability of mind. With the mindfulness becoming more continuous, there can be this possibility of shifting how the mind is perceiving experience. It's simply perception. The mind constructing what it knows and recognizing essentially that the experience is so constructed in the mind. This was a pretty powerful experience for me to see that shift of perception in an instant. And to see just how thoroughly the mind creates what it experiences. So back to the question of what's the benefit to noticing what's obvious. In terms of this style of practice, we start where it's most natural. What's already here, the kind of awareness that's already here. We're cultivating the stability of mindfulness where we are. And this cultivating the stability of mindfulness where we are helps us to be more aware at the ordinary level of experience. As the mindfulness gets more stable there at the ordinary level of experience, one way in here, I mean, the Mahasi approach kind of tries to take us down quickly to that more subtle level. This approach is exploring stabilizing the awareness in a very broad way with a whole variety of experiences, our ordinary experiences, our ordinary relationships in the world. And so in one way, we can say that this is valuable because it helps us to navigate our ordinary lives more skillfully. And in practicing this approach on long retreat, so I think this practice is ideal for daily life practice. I mean, it's like it is tailor-made for daily life practice. And I've seen and learned to really respect the power of this practice on retreat practice, where the mindfulness, when things are a little simpler, there's not quite as many things that, not the variety of things anyway, that happen in our day that tend to habitually pull us out of awareness, where really our only job on long retreat is to cultivate the mindfulness. And so what I've seen is that awareness at the ordinary level, as that stabilizes, very naturally, what can happen is that the mindfulness and the wisdom start to begin to get interested in the subtler levels. So there's like a drawdown. We start where it's easy and natural, and then as that gets more stable, very naturally the attention starts to see subtler experience, starts to understand how something ordinary is arising out of something deeper, an intention that's arising. And so there's a deepening of the mindfulness, of what the mindfulness is meeting, without trying to look for it, without trying to find it. And so one way to understand this practice is that it kind of creates a very broad and stable awareness at whatever level we're kind of naturally or kind of going in with. And then it deepens that broad and stable awareness to see subtler experience and subtler experience and subtler experience. And so instead of having a narrow and deep kind of attention that is, you know, I'd say the Mahasi approach goes narrow and deep and then broadens from there and tries to come back up to ordinary. And often I saw in my own experience and in talking to others that narrow, deep, hard, it seems hard to bring that back into ordinary awareness. This approach starts with ordinary and deepens and deepens and deepens. So it's broad from the beginning and it deepens. And by the time it gets to deep, it's pretty stable. So it's a different approach, and one that in my own experience feels very respectful of what's going on in the mind. It's not fighting the mind. There's probably a lot more to say there. You know, this is a... I could riff off of several pieces of what I just shared, but I'll stop. We'll stop now and take our break. So let's take a 10-minute break. So in the chat was a question of, did I ever finish the part about what I discovered in my first 6-week retreat with Zaido? And that piece, well, there's many things I discovered in that retreat, many, many things. It was really an eye-opening retreat. But the piece that I was pointing to was that broad, easy awareness leading to the continuity, the subtler and subtler, that I didn't have to do that focus in order to have the seeing of the subtlety didn't require that kind of narrow focus that I thought it did, that it could come through the just meeting what's here, what's here, what's here, that it would be drawn down to that subtler level. That was the point of that I wanted to point to. A kind of a riff, continuing riff on what that piece that I explored up, but I'm going to come at it from a different direction, from a question that came in. I'll read the question. If you set an intention to be mindful of, for example, impatience throughout the day, and as you said, see it in gross and subtle ways throughout the day, then what? Does recognizing it help to diminish it? The simple, or the short answer to the question is that recognizing it helps us to understand it. The understanding will allow some release, shifting of that pattern. So it's the growing of the understanding. And so this is a little bit of a kind of a danger almost, in a way, of like, okay, I want to pay attention to this impatience so that it will go away. There's some aversion in there, in just the very how we're paying attention. Our purpose for observing experience, the reason we observe, the kind of the view in the mind that supports the freedom, the release, is being curious about understanding impatience. What is this? That's not our usual approach. We want to get rid of it. So, a little bit perhaps about how this might work. Through a story, and I've told this story many times, so many of you may have heard this story. This is from the very first few months of my practice, and it's an appropriate story for a daily life retreat, in a way, because my interest at that time was completely not in sitting meditation. I was not at all interested in sitting down in meditation, but I was interested in understanding my mind, interested in understanding, in particular, the anger that was ruling my life at that point. And a friend had sent me a book about recognizing experience. And so I'm like, how could this possibly help? Being aware of my anger, how could this possibly help? I did not understand how it could be useful. But in some ways, fortunately, I had hit rock bottom and was willing to give something a try. So this really kind of a faith, or a sense of confidence that, I don't know how it's going to work, but my friend says it's useful, so I'll give it a try. And so the very first practice that I did really was this curiosity about what's it like to feel anger. With that, just that, what's this about? And so watching that, I watched that just in daily life, just seeing when it came up, just noticing it. I began to learn something about it. And I'd say one of the first things that really became very clear to me about the anger was that it was painful. And that was a little bit of a shock. And it's one of those questions like, why does the mind do this if it hurts so much? Well, it does it because it had a belief that the mind, and I could see this, that the mind believed that this anger was going to make somebody else miserable. And that was kind of like worth it in a way. And yet, this became kind of clear actually, because I was I was in the Peace Corps. I was in an island in the South Pacific. And the person that I was angry with was 7,000 miles away in California. And it was pretty clear that we had not been in communication. It was pretty clear that that person was not being touched by the anger. It was not making them miserable. But it was, boy, it was making me miserable. It was making me non-functional. There were times when I couldn't function. And so that recognition, it's like, wow, this is, that's the recognition in the Four Noble Truths. You know, somebody mentioned the three insights about each of the Four Noble Truths. This recognition, this is suffering. That's the first insight connected to the First Noble Truth. It's not a being wallowing in it, but it's a recognition. This is dukkha here in this being. The mind had not seen that before. The mind had thought it was somehow helping me by making the other person miserable. But the mind understood this is dukkha, this is suffering now for this being. So that's an important understanding. So in observing, for instance, impatience, one of the things that we get to know, one of the understandings that grows, is that impatience is suffering. It's painful. The mind is constricted, tight. So that's an understanding, an insight. This is suffering. So just watching that, and actually what I began to notice over the course of the time of watching this anger and what could possibly happen in watching any pattern, you know, impatience in this example, what I saw happening, and actually pretty quickly, I'd say within a few weeks of starting this project, of being curious about the anger that was like, you know, making me not able to function for stretches of time, you know, minutes and even, you know, as long as an hour at a time, I would just be in the world of the rage that I was in, not doing anything but being in the rage. So it was really disrupting my life. I began to notice in just a few weeks that the rage was not getting as strong. You know, it's like the mindfulness was starting to notice it earlier in the cycle of the anger, and that held it at a more kind of more ordinary level of anger, not the non-functional level of anger. And there was a possibility of, in seeing the anger, saying, wow, I don't know what to do with this, but I guess I just go back to work. You know, and the level of skill that I had with mindfulness was like, you know, this much at that point. This was the first like couple of weeks of my practice. I was not doing sitting meditation at all. I had no instructions about like turn the attention to the body, notice what's going on in the mind, notice other emotion. I had not heard any of that. I'd heard just notice that you're angry when you're angry. And it's like, wow, this hurts. That's about all I got out of that. So it was like just this light touch, the ordinary level of mindfulness. What's most obvious about this when you're angry? That's what I was doing. In retrospect, actually, when I met Sayadaw some, you know, 4 or 5 years later, 7 to 8 years later, and I began to learn his teaching. As I looked back to those first few months of my practice, I realized that naturally, the practice that he described is the practice my mind was doing at that time. It was just noticing the obvious. And at times just recognizing that it could set something aside. So that was a benefit also in this case of this very simple, obvious awareness. Could recognize the anger and, okay, yep, that's anger. And in some ways, fortunately, I didn't know what to do with it. You know, if I had had all these lessons about mindfulness, I might have gone, oh, let me turn and look at it and evaluate it and, you know, explore it, dive into it, which is what I ended up doing after I learned more about how to practice in some ways. But it was just kind of like, well, I don't know what to do with this. Okay, I guess I just go back to work. And in retrospect, also, that was another value, right? I could set it aside. I had been so absorbed in it, not able to make any other choice than being absorbed in it. And then mindfulness arose, noticed it was painful, and could set it aside. So that's all at the ordinary level, kind of the most obvious level. And just observing this for a few weeks, you know, began noticing that I wasn't getting as angry, kind of like mindfulness was coming in earlier in the process. And so, you know, just kind of more ordinary anger rather than rage. And then at one point, this process got me very attuned to the experience of anger, very attuned to the experience of the arising of anger. And at one point I was in my kitchen cutting an apple. And in that moment, I wasn't trying to be mindful. I wasn't, I was just kind of doing an ordinary thing. I was just cutting the apple. But in that moment, I saw a thought arise in the mind about the person I was angry with. And there was a connection. There was a connection between what I was doing. I was noticing a memory about being at a fruit stand with the person. And in that moment, I saw that the mind was headed in the direction of anger, to jump on the train and think more thoughts, to get angry. I think I mentioned this the other day, this piece of the understanding. And so in that moment, having spent the previous few weeks getting really familiar with the fact that anger is suffering, when awareness and wisdom arose in that moment, and this is actually a case of the mindfulness like suddenly deepening, because it saw in that place while I was cutting the apple, it saw the arising of a thought, it saw the arising of the intention to get angry, it saw that's going to be suffering, and it let it go, all within like the space of like a split second. But the mind saw that process very clearly unfold, from the arising of the thought to the mind saying, that way lies suffering. And wisdom letting it go, the real clear recognition, I did not do that, but that it happened. It happened, and it happened partly because the mind had been really familiar with, like, that way lies suffering. You know, we don't need to go there. I had no way of not making my mind go there, but seeing that wisdom, in that case, wisdom was arising and redirected the mind. It said, no, that's useless. That doesn't make any sense to follow that. And so that experience was kind of like in a moment, in an ordinary experience, cutting the apple, it's like there was a sudden deepening to seeing very precise experience. In a daily life experience, not in sitting meditation, just in everyday experience. The mind, and I think in some ways the mindfulness had been cultivated around the experience of anger enough that it was very attuned to what was happening around anger. And in that moment, it's just like, you know, I wasn't even trying to be mindful, but mindfulness arose. And in a split second, it's like I got this burst of continuity and saw very clearly how the mind let that go. So that's a kind of example too. It's like, you know, when I described the broad awareness that maybe slowly deepens, you know, sometimes in this practice too, there's this broad awareness that can drop very quickly to a very precise, clear unfolding of experience. And if there's a kind of availability to know that this mindfulness is arising and what have the curiosity about the experience, the mind can see something and be released from it in that moment. Now, in that example, you know, that was not the end of my anger. You know, it definitely came back. But there was such a kind of a deep understanding that the mind is creating this and that it has an option, that there was much more curiosity about exploring that in the mind. And so again, you know, the point of, so come back to the question, does impatience, if you notice impatience throughout the day and see it in gross and subtle ways, then what? Does recognizing it help it diminish? If we're recognizing and curious about it for the sake of understanding it, that wisdom will in its own time support a release and a shift away from the suffering aspects of the pattern. You know, sometimes another question around what might be sound like impatience about somebody noticing in just being aware that there's a strong pattern of in pretty much everything they're doing, what's next? Noticing that while eating a meal, they're already thinking about what to have for dessert, hiking on a trail, thinking about the work I need to do when I get home, putting the laundry in the washer, I'm working out this question that I'm asking you. So it's always the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. So seeing this pattern, this is a really common pattern. You are not alone. Whoever wrote this question, you are not alone. This is kind of natural in a way for us to, it's part of the functioning of our minds to not, you know, it's like we couldn't just completely live in the present moment and live our lives. I mean, not that's not quite right. That's not said quite right. We need to think thoughts about the future in order to live our lives. We can be aware about thoughts of the future in the present moment as thoughts arising in the present moment. And habitually, we may tend to relate to those thoughts with impatience or with greed or with aversion. Those thoughts themselves are useful for navigating our lives. So there's, when I said earlier, you know, that the wisdom will release us from the part of the pattern that's suffering. So around this pattern of what's next, what's next, what's next, there may be some greed, there may be some impatience, there may be some not willingness to be with what's here because we want to construct something that's better in the future, not really here. And so in the being aware of this pattern, what might happen is that relationship of greed or impatience begins to weaken and fall away. But and probably the amount of that pattern will weaken because so much of those thoughts do come from impatience, do come from not being willing to be here. And yet there may well be in having some wisdom arise, the recognition of, yeah, right now, like this morning, you know, before I sat down, it's like, the mind realized, oh, I need to look at the questions. So looked at the questions. You know, it's like that doesn't have to come out of greed or impatience. It's just the natural functioning of the mind that it kind of looks forward to navigate the world. And yet being aware of them, of those thoughts, can help us to recognize which ones are from the place of greed or aversion or impatience, and which ones are more just kind of navigating our lives. So the patterns of our mind, you know, they often have a kind of a mixture of reactivity and wanting or aversion or confusion. And they can also have a mixture of just the normal processes that kind of take care of us. And if we think we have to like get rid of the thoughts that think about the future, our mind is not going to go along with that because we need to think thoughts about the future. And so again, the mindfulness, the curiosity about what's here, oh, thinking thoughts about the future. Is there constriction while thinking thoughts about the future? Or is there a sense of openness and spaciousness? The mind begins to tease apart through this curiosity and orientation to being aware of what's the experience as a human being of having these thoughts about the future. And some pieces of the experience may have that constriction, and some parts of the experience might be just what we need to do. And so the mindfulness and wisdom kind of begin to tease apart these threads, and it will release the wisdom that grows will tend to release the suffering parts. And then we can be aware while thinking thoughts of the future, not have any kind of a judgment about them, but just like, oh, there's a thought of the future. Is this, and not even in our daily lives, just thinking, but knowing the content, knowing, is this useful? Is this a useful thought to be connecting with? Is it supporting? Is it supporting the movement of my life in a skillful way? Or is it caught in reactivity?